This is tape recording number 5011C25A and B. A tape recorded lecture given by L. Ron Hubbard on the 25th of November, 1950. The title of this lecture is ARC and the Four Dynamics. Side A is 58 minutes and 13 seconds long. Side B is 85 minutes and 25 seconds long. Copyright C, 1950-1974 by L. Ron Hubbard. All world performance rights reserved. This recording has been re-recorded by the Flag Audio Unit of the Flagship Apollo of the Sea Organization. And now, here is L. Ron Hubbard.
How you use this data which I have been giving you. How we apply this and coordinate it with standard procedure. We have talked about affinity, communication, and reality. And truth is that if we look over a survival chart, one of these four tone charts here, and this being tone 0, 1, 2, 3, and 4, we find out that, well, let's say here's your survival arrow, and here's the suppressor. Now, you know this from the book, this material. But let's take a magnifying glass here, and let's look, put the magnifying glass right on there, and we will find out that we have here affinity, communication, and reality. That is the how this survival arrow is surviving. It has three components. The very interesting part of it is there's one of these tone scales in every person for every dynamic. So you could call this tone scale that I've just shown you here the first dynamic graph on an individual. Then you could rub that out and we could draw it all over again. We'd say this is the second dynamic graph on the individual. And we could rub that out and we'd say this is the third dynamic. Rub that out and it'd be the fourth. In other words, there are four of them. And each one has its component parts of how it's surviving: affinity, communication, reality. You see? It has this tone scale has application then to the individual, the progeny, the future, sex. It has application into the group and has application in mankind. And I only need to tell you this to show you how well this can be applied to mankind when I show you the mankind drive for all of mankind right now. Here we have this graph. We draw this up just for mankind, about mankind, and we find out that as far as this reality is concerned, races from here to there are badly out agreement with one another about how they should conduct their business of surviving. See, they're not in agreement on how they should do it. So there goes reality as far as mankind's attitude toward mankind is concerned. They, by the way, didn't know many of the facts. And of course, not knowing many of the facts, not having very much of the truth on the thing, you couldn't have expected a reality to have existed there anyway. So, now, let's talk about the languages of mankind and their methods of communicating in general. We find out that they all see, feel, hear, and so on, so that they do have that in common, but their languages are such and so polyglot that they are out of communication. And I mean group to group, really out of communication. How many in this room speak Russian? All right, so there goes communication. Now what happens to this? We've got affinity left here. You know, somebody postulated not too long ago, and not too seldom, matter of fact, far too often, that man was a very evil character. He had no love in his soul. And a great many organizations from time to time in the history of man have jumped up to say, well, man is a dog, but we're going to try to make him love his fellow man. This, by the way, is a manic. We have to teach man to love man. And right away they take off on this level and in order to convince man that he must be taught that he must love his fellow man, they first have to convince him that he's a dog and that he hates his fellow man, and there goes affinity. That's war now, because there aren't any of those things. This says no survival. I wouldn't give a plugged copper for the survival value of mankind at large if he continues along a highly mechanistic line of action with good guns and good tanks and good atom bombs and so forth. And we look at this and it predicts that his survival is awfully poor. It says so. And you look around and look at the facts. Now compare it to the real world. This is theoretical. Now let's compare the theoretical to the real world, and we find people slugging through the snow and drizzle of Korea, shooting up other people, and we find some very remarkable setups going on in the world right now, and we find people just, well, you know, we haven't heard lately about bacteriological warfare, but I ran into an officer the other day, and he says, boy, we're doing some wonderful work. It looks like we could wipe out all the cattle in Europe. Great. Nobody's been coming along here and saying, look at here, unless we can somehow, some way, put some effort into sketching in some of this one and this one and this one and put that vector back where it belongs, boom. The way to do it is to speed up and increase your communication lines. Make these good. We're just practically up to our necks these days in ways and means to communicate. Better use them. Over here on the reality side, somebody better sit down and find out what is the reality of all this. Should the world go to pieces because of somebody's cockeyed idea? How real is that idea, for instance, that the way for Europe to survive, or the way for, let's say, of Asia to survive, for a couple of 100,000 Chinese troops to go streaming up into Tibet and shoot everybody they get their hands on. Is that very real? No, it sure isn't. Well, how do we go about establishing some sort of truth? What is the truth of the situation? Let's examine it. A body exists at this moment which can examine the truth of such situations if it would ever permit itself to hear truth and not parliamentary protocol. And that's the United Nations. So, they can find out what the reality is, and by communication they can spread it around. And affinity would pick up. I can sit down with any dozen Russian officers and have them in perfect agreement that the only way to run the world is by a democracy. That's right, I've done it. Only trouble is, I just never used the word democracy. They agree perfectly with this political principle that no government which is unsupported by the majority of its people can long exist. Right? They agree to that, they've agreed to democracy immediately. It's very interesting, the very sloppy ideas people have of all of these ideologies. These ideologies are things that walk around, and you ask them suddenly to define these things, and they can't tell you the first fundamental of one of these things. Actually, democracy is a method of organizing. It is the basic method of organizing. You can't call democracy an ideology because it's an organizational plan. It says the best and smoothest way to run the country is to let the people make their decisions about how they want to run the country, and when we get the thing running this way, then if there's any beef, it's their fault, so why should they revolt? Well, this is an old one, and it's the safest way to run a government. Matter of fact, the foundations were having a bad time here and there and so forth, and we're getting out of agreement with one of another. Until, back in Elizabeth, the boys kicked together a staff meeting. I got back there, looked over their staff conference. It was set up actually on a management line. A couple of guys on the board were just frantic at the idea of employees suddenly setting up management. Well, maybe Western Electric or the Chrysler Corporation can get scared on a management basis. But what the dickens? This belongs to that staff anyhow. So, you just issue orders authorizing the staff to go on and manage. And the place is running like a clock. That's democracy at work. Now, on top of a democracy, You can build almost anything you want. But a nation which is not running on democratic principles, that is to say, let's really call them democratic principles now, and let's say that the people in this country have a good right to say what goes on in this country, and they have individual rights which must be safeguarded, and we think of that. And if we lay that down as a basic, then we can go ahead and do almost anything else we want to. Because on that basic, then you start putting economic pins. This is not a talk on political dynamics. I'm just demonstrating to you that here is a common meeting point of all governments. Do your people agree that you should govern them? And if the fellow says no, we have to take great punitive measures in order to keep them in line. You can absolutely guarantee this. That government is shortly going to cease to exist. You just look back along the historical track and you will find out that governments cease to exist when they disagree with too many of their populaces. There is no weapon to date that will stop a mob. Really, you can kill the whole mob off, but then you haven't got anybody to govern. All governments have been up against this sad fact. All right, now, we have examined then this on the basis of the fourth dynamic, and we see where its elements fit in. Now we go back on the third dynamic. We look at any organization. This is a nice little thing for an analysis of an organization. Third dynamic, the group. Let's look over the problems of the group in these terms. Let's find out how much affinity there is in this group, one for the next. And let's find out how much people in this group are able to talk to and be with, in general, other people in the group. And let's find out what is the agreement of all of these people in the group on the subject of the goals of the group. And if we look over those factors and analyze them, we will be able to predict the survival of the group, or its non-survival. For instance, let's take a new company, a new corporation that's going to build washing machines. And this corporation gets going and they get what they think are the right people to handle manufacturing and handle sales and handle this and handle that, but they don't get anybody to handle personnel. And they get spreading out very large, and one day you come along and you don't find anything happening in the way of the washing machines are not coming off the end of the assembly line. But they have the best production manager that they can get hold of. He sits there and he makes these beautiful graphs and he draws these blueprints and so forth, and still no washing machines come off the end of the line. You can do an analysis on that company with regard to these three factors, and you'll be able to spot the trouble and fit in the missing factors which will create these things in the group. And the second these are created in the group, it will start to function as a live group, and washing machines will start to come off the end of the assembly line. The main trouble that has happened is that the big corporations didn't understand, for instance, communication and the necessities and needs of communication between management and employee. They didn't understand several things. One of the things that they failed completely to understand was that the employee was doing the most work, and the aggregate mass of employees were doing the most work. So the employees tried to tell them this, and management wouldn't listen. And all of a sudden, there were these two camps of management and labor. And they've been going to the races ever since. If anybody can possibly demonstrate to me that there are these two entities in a corporation of management and labor, it must be that he's a government efficiency expert or something. Because the fact is that management comes on down the line in a sort of a spectrum. Everybody is doing some managing, and everybody is doing some labor. You should see some of these people who are managers of big corporations and so forth. If you ever saw anybody labor, it's those people. That's a really midnight to midnight task, trying to keep up with this organization. Now, those companies which have provided a house organ, which have a pretty good social activities programs and so on, they get along fine. because your people are getting into communication with one another. And companies which don't have a highly punitive attitude toward their employees, of course, have a chance for the affinity to build up. But, for instance, I saw a ship go all to pieces one time. Captain came on board the ship who hated enlisted men. He had been one himself too long. He hated them. But it never really got through to the enlisted men, because after all, this ship was built out of 160 years of tradition to keep the thing together. And it was going pretty well until one day he was up on the bridge and all the men were sent out on maneuvers at dawn. And the captain came up on the bridge and he said, "Why aren't these boats away from the side? It's supposed to be, they're supposed to leave here at 5:45 a.m. And somebody tried to tell him that the galley ranges had broken down at about 4 o'clock and that the electricians had gotten them fixed by about 10 of 5 and that they were trying to get some hot food into these men before they sent them out in these ships, in these boats, because they were going to be gone all day. And the captain, standing up on the bridge, says, "Well, I don't give a goddamn whether they get any hot food or not. They're a bunch of dogs anyway." He said, "Get them over the side and into those boats and be quick about it." Quite by accident, somebody had leaned on the PA, the public address system.
"Now hear this."
"Now hear this," that's right. That guy was cooked. He didn't dare come off of his bridge, actually. He spent the rest of his cruise on that ship on his bridge, and he expected any time to be thrown over the side. This completely broke off communications. If he'd had nerve enough, actually, it's true, if he'd had nerve enough at that moment to have gone down and given these guys a personal growl and said, "What the hell's wrong with you people? Go on, get over the side," and so forth, it wouldn't have had very much repercussion, you see, because he was been still in communication with them. But instead of that, the second he recognized that PA system had been on, the guy was not what you might call a courageous lion, he dived immediately into his cabin and locked the door. Which, of course, boom, cut off communication, and so on. Finally, by the way, a Lieutenant J.G. and about four ensigns took to running the ship. And it smoothed out. People would do their jobs, but boy, they sure hated to be on board that time. Well, you can look into any organization, and you can find out what factors are breaking it up. Now, I spoke of a house organ a moment ago on the line of communication, something that's published regularly, and something that comes out and is handed to the people, and they read this thing. It's an interesting thing that this line of communication, as all lines of communication have, has a modifier in terms of reality. You see, a lot of these house organs don't quite deal in what one might call complete truth. And the second anybody begins to find that house organ to be untrue in any way, of course, as a communication channel, it's chopped off. Now, the management can spend $1 million on that, getting the best editors, getting the best paper, printing at the best time, and all of that sort of thing, and handing it out to the employees, but that magazine or house organ is dead. It's not a communication line. What does one do, for instance, with a communication line which proves itself to be false? He cuts it off. Now, a communication line, somebody is found to be a chronic and constant liar. Then he comes in, the little boy who tells the story, the wolf story. He cries wolf several times, and every time people find there is no wolf, and so the last time he cries wolf, why, there are wolves, and the sheep get all et up, and the little boy gets all et up, and it's all very sad. But what's happened there is very interesting. He has been proven to be a false channel for communication, so he's cut off, and that's what would happen. We were putting together a newsletter the other day through the foundations. We were working, we know these things. We were putting together a newsletter, and somebody came charging down from the management level and said, "What on earth? You've got so-and-so to write this letter, and my good heavens, don't you realize that he'll have to be thoroughly supervised as to what he says?" And so he walked out, and the boy who was writing the newsletter walked in, and I gave him a little chit, and it said, "The editorial policy of this newsletter shall be what the editor says it is. The news which is written in this newsletter will be what the editor puts into it." Because instantly that newsletter had gone under a barrage of censorship, it might have gotten it up so that it was a cheerier organ. It might have gotten it up to the point where nobody would have mentioned the fact that Doakes the other day, when auditing, let a guy bounce out of 18 consecutive engrams and the fellow went into a spin. It might omit these items, and this all might be very cheery, but that's not communication. Communication would include the reality of everything that was going on, you see. That's how communication has to be done. It has to be true, or it's not communication. The second it is discovered not to be communication, that is, discovered to be false, nobody pays any attention to it anymore, and it just cuts right off. One of the reasons why the American press is declining. The American press has been having, by the way, a very hard time in terms of circulation. They blamed it on the radio, they blamed it on almost everything, but they never thought to blame it on themselves. The quality of reporting which is done these days is pretty lousy. It's a fact. I've checked back over some of the stories, not having anything to do with Dianetics, back before the war. I just got interested in the general caliber, and I find out that the whole American press seems desperately to want to slant itself in favor of this and slant itself in favor of that. About the only way that you could put out a news organ that would be a news organ and people would accept well and constantly would be one which told bluntly the truth as they saw it. And if they couldn't arrive at the truth in any other way, then they'd write a pro story and a con story on the same subject. So they'd have the two stories and the two viewpoints, and then people could read them and make up their own mind. You see, this adds to the self-determinism of an individual. If he knows that he's getting truth and he is permitted to make a selection of what seems most likely to him. One of the main things that happens to a police state, a totalitarian state, is the fact that it warps its press. It gets, it gets as bad as Look magazine. And the press is so constantly and consistently full of lies that the press, which is a main line of communication amongst the people, ceases to exist as a line of communication, and the society goes out of touch with itself. See, because it's a lying press, nobody believes it. All right? You chop this one. By cutting this one, one chops this one, and then this one goes. Affinity. Then the country will start to fall apart. So we see what happens with a group. Now let's take up the second dynamic. We're considering this now as the second dynamic. Let's take it on the subject of what they talk about in the songs of just plain love. All right? Actually, you have two individuals who together as thought entities are going to create the vehicle of new thought into the future. Hence the pleasurable aspect of sex. We get the reverse on this, and we get two people who are going to knock off and murder the future, and we get pain. You see, it's whether or not thought is permitted to perpetuate itself or it's stopped in its perpetuation. Death stops it, death is pain, and a creation of new vehicles for thought to exist in the future, of course, makes for a great deal of pleasure. So here's where we get the intensity, then, of sex, because it takes two people to come together. All right, so we look this thing over, and we find out that they're in very intimate communication, perceptically. So this goes way up. This one, then, of course, and for other reasons, goes way up. Dedication to purpose, that goes way up. And over here, the truth of that purpose and so forth is not even slightly questioned by them in their actual states. Aberratively, it is questioned. So you see that on the second dynamic, we get a great intensity of this sort of thing. Now, a family which is part of that same group. A family slops over from group back into the second dynamic. It's a cross. That makes the family, by the way, a very strong unit because it fits on two dynamics. It fits on the sex dynamic for the future, and it also fits on the group dynamic for mutual defense and aid. So we find the family being a very strong group. And when we look at a family, we find out that if they are going forward, they're
the punk,
and bring them up into good men and women and really do a good job of it, the affinity amongst that family is going to increase, because that is dedication to purpose, and that is a natural purpose, and it happens to be true. Everybody will agree on this fairly well, except some very aberrated people. And it happens to be true, and the affinity of it builds up, and communication lines of it build up. Now, the main thing that happens in breaking down marital relations happens to be a breakdown of understanding, a breakdown of communication. One person cannot understand why the other person would not, and they finally just fall out of a direct relationship to each other, and you get divorces. It's a fact. Most of these things are based on the most confoundedly aberrated misunderstandings that just break off communication. That's the first symptom you get of a future divorce. That's very strong. Now, let's take self. This might strike you as a little odd, considering this is first dynamic now. Might strike you as a little odd that one would have affinity and communication and reality with himself and about himself. But without these things, a person is not very sane and certainly is not very happy. I can give you quite a bit on this. Let's take the question of I. I, one might say, in an unaberrated state, would be about as close to the central purposes of little theta. I've been talking about the world of thought, that is the universe of thought, which is attacking the universe of matter, I would be very close in purpose and so on to the little theta, so that I agrees and I is little theta in this attack on the material universe. Now let's start pushing I away from these dedications of purpose, and it's I is effort to control and so on, and let's just start dropping collision and pain in on I. Well, the more this happens, the more I is forced into a situation whereby it cannot forward little theta's plans. It gets driven into a very, very bad state. And the thing that happens is that I, little theta, breaks with the body, which is big theta, mainly, you see. And the various portions of the body are in themselves sections of thought and life. And they break apart. In other words, the organism is not a unity. The organism has many identities within it, actually. There's the cells and the various functions of the body and these various things. And they can be seen to go to war with one another when there's a great deal of pain present. So it gets out of line. And individuality, you might say, starts cutting in direct ratio to the amount of pain as far as these cells are concerned. This postulates a very interesting thing. It seems that possibly Lord knows how long ago that little in attacking the material universe was simply little theta. And it was doing a good job, and it was very much in communication with all of its unities and entities. And then it started to collide with the material universe, and it lost some ground here, and it gained some ground there, and it lost some ground someplace else. And it was a pretty hard job, and little by little, pieces of little theta sort of broke off. The environmental aspect. I mean, the strength of that. That's Stalin's fourth dynamic. You see, in these terms of environment. We're not talking now about aberration. Look at him. He's protected in a place, guarded. He is talked to and contacted only by the same people continually. Generally, stuff is very tightly screened as it comes through. He's generally and continuously in the same environment because of the rigors of management, which have mostly to do with thought. He doesn't have a chance to go out and ride a horse or take a look at the countryside or so forth. He's too pinned down. And we look at all these factors, and what would we say Stalin's environmental aspect on the fourth dynamic would be? We'd say it'd be damn bad. It would be second only probably to Truman's. These people with this aspect are controlling individuals who have better sense. I'm not advocating they both ought to be shot, but I think somebody ought to wise them up a little bit. So we see this whole pattern through the one individual, and when we regard him as one individual, then regard him as being influenced by all four dynamics, regard him as being impinged upon by these three things in each one of the dynamics: breaks of affinity, breaks of communication, breaks of reality and agreement. Along each one of the four dynamics, look there at the, you have something now from which you can derive an enormous number of new thoughts with regard to treating your preclear. Let us take a look at the fellow for a while. Let's just not worry about this one little narrow periphery of his first dynamic or whether or not he likes his sex life. Let's not worry about that as just that narrow a field. Let's take a look at the whole sphere of life, the whole spread of life, and see how these things have affected him, and line these up and see what people in his vicinity were suppressors on the subject of these various points. Who were the suppressors on the subject of man at large? Who was the suppressor about the group, about politics, about the church, about any of the rest of these things? Who were the suppressors about various institutions in his vicinity, such as that of marriage? All these things had an effect upon him. Anybody who was breaking affinity, communication, and reality on any one of these subjects was potentially dangerous to the sanity of this individual if this material lay in the actual engrams of the individual. Remember, all this comes down to the physical pain and unconsciousness of an engram. This material, our mechanistic principle over here, the mechanical aspects of the engram, and the statement side of the engram combined together to lay as underpinning for all of this. We're trying to get to this underpinning and take it out. But we've got to have ways and means to unburden this mind, to gain accessibility to this mind to a point where we can run these engrams out rapidly and successfully. That's, never take your eye off of that ball, by the way, that you're trying to get engrams, finally, in the final analysis. But you'd better be able to get engrams and run them out eventually, when you start the real case erasure on this thing, to run them out in their own valence and to run them out into a complete and true erasure of 26 perceptics in every engram. And that's what you're evolving toward as you do therapy on this person. What I'm giving you is material that you can look for in forms of locks and so on, so that you can pick up more and more attention units, so that you can put this person better and better together, so that you can brighten up his sense of reality, so that you can reach what the circuits are, and so that you have some comprehension of how many kinds of circuits there are and how many things these circuits can suppress. A circuit doesn't only come under the category of control yourself or I have to tell you what to do. A circuit can go into the basis of nobody in a labor union knows what he is talking about. That in the head, by the way, of a man as an engram, physical pain, unconsciousness, probably in the prenatal area someplace, that stranger things than that are in engrams. And think of what this sort of thing does to a company, being in the head of its manager. Now you see how the circuits can influence and how broadly these aberrations can affect their ways. I'm going to go into this. I've been talking to you very broadly on a theoretical basis, mainly trying to show you the practicalities of reaching people and trying to show you how many are the factors that influence the sanity of people, and yet trying to show you how infinitely simple those factors are when you resolve them down. There aren't very many of them. The basic factors are few. There are four dynamics, and each one of the four dynamics can be graphed in this fashion, and each one of those four dynamics, arrows, can be broken down into these three things. And you're looking for what broke those three things so as to suppress these on any one of the dynamics. It's very easy to find, and right after the break, I will give you what I know about that. Thank you. This chart is the accessibility chart, which complements the standard procedure chart. This chart gives you a measure by which you can tell what to do with the case from an estimate that you make of the accessibility of the case. Now, in the standard procedure chart, you will find that it starts out for accessible cases. And it sort of starts out, you might say, fully mounted and at a gallop. We never bothered to go back and point out how you got on the horse. It's awfully important if you're going to ride to be on the horse. Most any cowboy can tell you that. And this is how you get on the horse so that you can run standard procedure. Now, don't think that we have for a moment thrown standard procedure overboard or that there's anything vastly changed about it. Regarded in this light, however, it is much broader. Your entrance points are seen to be much broader than they were before. I want you people to be able to break the toughest cases, even unto the psychotic case. Now, we point out immediately that accessibility is a relative matter. The only fully accessible person would be a clear. The word accessible, by the way, is very well taken. The accessibility that I has to the rest of the organism. The accessibility that the world has to I. I's accessibility to the world is at its optimum in a clear. But we begin to drop curtains between I and the standard banks, between I and the universe, and I and his fellows and so forth. And the first thing you know, I gets pretty inaccessible. Actually, this is a study of the submergence of I. The I, for instance, in an optimum state, would be very much on top and running his own show in cooperation with other people and so forth. That's the natural way for this to be. But the organism has gone into collision with the material universe here and there, and what we have been calling MEST, which is matter, energy, space, and time, have won here and there and have driven thought back a bit. And every time they did, that's pain. Very complicated example of this would be a small boy knocking his shins on a rock. He has, at that moment, broken affinity with MEST. His shin broke affinity with it, and he, to some degree, not only broke affinity with MEST, but also broke affinity with his shin. You see, the shin hurt him. So this gets submerged on a totally mechanical line. Now, when I have used this word mechanical and mechanistic, by the way, I talk about thought function, the mechanical aspects of thought function. I have not been talking about, and somebody mistook this a while ago, I have not been talking about the structural aspects. I haven't been talking about broken arms as a structural inability. I haven't been talking about a cleft palate as a structural impediment to communication. I have been talking exclusively about function. And all the way through, Dianetics talk only about function. So when I talk about the functional aspects of the engram, I'm talking about the way the pain is insisted, the way the thing is cut off from I, the way various other breakdowns have occurred. That's functional mechanics. All by itself, pain and any of the perceptics create themselves functional disorders. In the engram, you see, the function of thought is interrupted. The function of thought gets interrupted by pain, whereby thought, by an impact or shock from the material universe, impinges itself upon the matter which thought has already captured. See, you consider thought as, in the progress, a raid, you might say, on the material universe. It's taking it over more and more, and it's making the natural laws of the material universe turn around on the material universe and conquer and take over more and more the material universe. And it's using the material universe pretty well against itself in this fashion. All right, all of a sudden, there's a disruption of this. Thought has captured this sector, and suddenly the impingement of the two is very sudden and sharp. The reaction there is pain. That's pain, and it's registered as a turbulence between thought and mist, the material universe. And that turbulence resides there, and it's an area which goes, you might say, out of communication, because it's something that thought shouldn't have done. And it's the material universe to that degree has won. And what you're doing in Dianetics is pulling apart and straightening up all these areas of turbulence so that thought, again, can take over that area. Thought has been debarred out by the turbulence caused by mist in an area, and when you start to erase engrams, physical pain, engrams, and so on, you're straightening out thought in those areas and removing these areas of turbulence, so you get a free flow and a free play of thought through its own organism and through all the organisms of the society and so on. Now, that's a basic definition of processing. Now, when you get too much turbulence in an individual, I is pretty well submerged. I becomes rather out of contact with the body, with memory, with the past, and so forth. You get actually occlusions, and on functional mechanics, these occlusions take place. I is not going to penetrate into an area which has been very severely hurt, because that was dangerous once, it's dangerous again. Therefore, I doesn't go back into that area again, and that area, therefore, goes out of communication to some degree. You get a psychosomatic illness, by the way, because an area has gone thoroughly out of communication. One eye is unable to tell what's going on in that area, and the functional mechanisms of the body can't heal that area properly, and so on, and we get trouble in that. We get psychosomatic illnesses and so on. All right, so that I can get pretty well submerged by these impacts. And after it gets just so many of these impacts, I, looking for the danger, can't see into these areas, which it must not approach mechanically. Can't see into those, and begins to scatter its attention and look for the trouble in the vicinity. And in looking for that trouble, various things happen which re-stimulate this functional mechanical thing, this engram, and the re-stimulation of that, moments of this sudden and severe re-stimulation, become locks on that engram. So that I, on a conscious level, is looking at what has happened to him in his analytical life, has avoided what has happened to him in the functional pain areas, and so has attributed all of I's trouble to this analytical sphere. And having made that fundamental error, errors multiply very rapidly from there. I can get so thoroughly submerged that a person becomes psychotic. In other words, I is not in contact at all. At this moment, personality is inaccessible. This is your psychotic. Either you're computational psychotic or you're engram psychotic. The engram psychotic, of course, they're both engram psychotics, but I should change that terminology, the dramatizing psychotic. He is dramatizing just one engram, and he's going through probably just one valence of one engram, and he goes through it over and over and over and over again. Then there's the psychotic whose mind has been taken over, you might say, by another entity, another eye of super control on it, and he is computing and it is a strange kind of computation he does, but he's computing on one or more circuits, and he is an animated circuit. But I, the actual I of the individual, is submerged, and it is your task in processing to rehabilitate this I that has become submerged, the real I of the individual, to a point where it can again command the organism. That is the basic definition of the treatment of psychotics. You can do this by establishing some affinity, some communication, and some reality between you as an auditor and the I, not with the demon circuit, with the actual I of the individual. It's a strange thing, but in a psychotic person, if you insist on talking to I, and you just keep on talking to I as though the person is rational and so forth, first thing you know, I begins to build up in strength. Another area of little theta, you might say, you as an auditor can move in on the individual and rehabilitate the actual entity. And you can build that entity back up again, and the person becomes, his personality may become, should become accessible. Now that is the lowest level of it. Accessibility, people are generally considered psychotic in this society only when they are violent, dangerous to themselves or dangerous to the society. There are many other people in the society who are actually equally psychotic, but who are apparently tractable. They are no more inaccessible than the raving maniac. They will sit in a living room and they will tell you, meanwhile, nursing a terrific case of arthritis, I'm fine, there's nothing wrong with me, and so on, and they'll go on about how this and that and other things, and that nothing should be done for them, and they're okay, and yak, 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 yak. They're also inaccessible people, and you establish communication with them. Build up some affinity, build up some reality, and you're contacting the actual I, and you'll get some processing done on this person. So, as soon as you get the personality accessible, a person's refusal of auditing when they obviously need it is an inaccessible personality. You understand that. And you've got to build up the accessibility of that personality. You don't do it by disagreeing with them. You do it by agreeing with them. In other words, you establish affinity, communication, reality with this person, and you establish the reality of what you're trying to do. This little validation booklet that we're getting out is highly therapeutic to the society because it demonstrates the reality of Dianetic processing. And to a lot of people who are just on an educational basis inaccessible to you, and so on, will immediately become accessible to you on the presentation of such evidence. That builds up the reality, so they'll build up a little affinity with you, and you're in communication with them, and you can get some processing done. So that's another stage of inaccessibility. And finally, we get this person up to a point where we can give them straight memory. We're actually, at this point, in step 3 of the standard procedure chart. This is about the best we can do. See, we get a little straight memory on this person. We can hit them with step 3 if we can't get an inventory out of them. Sometimes you'll be able to work one against the other, and you may get an inventory out of them and get some straight wire done. This inventory all by itself puts you into communication with the person and puts I in communication with his own past and is therapeutic so that you can start your accessibility with that inventory. The person has to be able to answer your questions, has to be able to remember something of his past life, however, before you can get an inventory out of him. So your step 3 can be gone into at this point with the inventory, actually. When were you sick, and who was your father and mother, and so on. So step 1, step 3 can be done simultaneously off the standard procedure chart. You see why that is. And it builds up the accessibility of the person. So if this person can't be put into reverie and can't be put back down the track again, you certainly can get some straight wire on this person. You can get him remembering. You can build up your affinity, communication, reality with this person to the point where he'll remember. Then we get into this. In order to, you see, I could be postulated as consisting of a number of attention units. And these attention units can get very badly distributed down the person's time track so that I has less and less attention units. If you could bring a person 100% to present time, he would be sane. That's what happens, you see. These physical pain and turbulence areas capture thought, capture his life force one by one. And if you could just pull these things up out of there, be in good shape. Now, an engram has to be restimulated before it'll capture any of these life units.
In other words, an engram could be a sleeper, unrestimulated, would have no great effect upon the individual at all. And having no great effect upon him, it would have any effect. Actually, a person could live for 70 years with a serious chain, let's say, of AAs, and not one phrase of the AAs ever be restimulated. Nothing would get keyed in. This is practically unthinkable that this should happen, but theoretically can be postulated. As you're processing people, you will find all kinds of engrams which were never in restimulation. You just knock them out as a matter of course. Because as you go into the bank, it's necessary for you to knock them out because they're in the road as you come up the line. You are actually restimulating them for the first time, some of these engrams, in the process of getting rid of them. Some artist, for instance, you're working on has an engram that says, I can't paint, I can't draw, I can't do anything, and it's never been active. You put this one into restimulation on him for a couple of days in the process of getting out a chain of criticism and so forth. This poor guy's not going to be able to do any work. But it was temporary. Now, that's why, by the way, every session should be ended by straight memory, running some pleasure moments, and by straight memory. Every session should be ended with that. That's part of standard procedure, but it isn't written down. So, we get some straight memory on this person, then we start heading for locks. Minor incidents where he has suffered breaks.
Application.
Invalidations of his reality and breaks of his own affinity with life. So, these are little locks. We're going into this very mildly. Let's go into this case mildly and look it over, and we'll find out that these locks exist. And these locks, every time that engram was restimulated, it took another couple of attention units, you see, off of I. And I got just that much weaker because this engram was restimulated. Now, you can pick up these restimulations of these engrams by straight memory, and you can return a certain amount of I to itself. Every time I gets stronger, the answer to coax into the spot of pleasure as many attention units as you can pull back. You may have distributed some down the track yourself in the process of processing. So you run a pleasure moment, and this has tendency to centralize those attention units, and then you bring him up to present time, and you've got more eye there. Then you run him straight memory on the session of processing, and you rescue what attention units additionally that you laid back down on the track, and you get all this up in the present time. And eye is pretty stable in, and your pre-clear feels a lot better if you do this. All right. You're looking for just minor locks. I'll describe these and draw you a little chart here in a moment showing you what you look for in terms of those locks. But it could be if you're trying to rehabilitate communication with this person. So you try to get back, communication is perception. So we just go back down the track and we just with straight memory and say, do you remember anybody who used to say you can't see it? The person will think for a moment and they'll say, well, yeah, my father used to say that. Well, let's remember a moment when he said it. Yeah, yes, I remember when he said it. You've broken a little lock right at that point, which is on the communication line. Or who in your family used to talk about eyesight? You look at your pre-clear C's wearing glasses, you know very well somebody was talking about eyesight or couldn't see it or something of the sort. Somebody broke off communication in that channel someplace. By straight memory, we start recovering it. We start recovering this, and the first thing you know, we've got quite a bit of attention unit up there with eye. Now we can take him back down the track, and we can run these locks as engrams, actually. No, you see, the difference between a lock and an engram is that there is no physical pain, actually, in the lock. No physical pain in it, but it is a restimulation of a time when there was physical pain. So we just knock out the restimulation time, and the engram has a tendency to go back and be a sleeper. If you could recover all the attention units off all the locks in a case, you would have clear. He'd be very temporary clear because the thing would restimulate, his engrams would restimulate again, but he would give the aspects of clear, briefly. Now, so you get those locks with straight memory, and then you can come in down the line here and you look over this person, and actually you can go from here to here. We're trying to find out where to enter this case, you see, and you try to get some grief off of this case. Now, I'm going to change the name of these things here, and I'm going to call them secondary engrams and give you a definition for the secondary engram. A primary engram, or an actual engram, is one which contains physical pain and unconscious great big lock. big, sudden impact, a terrific restimulation of that basic engram. The death of a person causes a grief charge. Now, therefore, a grief engram or an apathy engram, you see, or a very tough anger engram, and so on, would be a secondary engram, because all of these things have in them is charge. I has received an impact from his environment. He's received this impact from his environment, and it has restimulated physical pain back here in the background, and the two of them come together, crunch. Actually, the engram has been charged up. It has been recharged, you might say, by this experience. You get analytical attenuation and so on, and that charge, the loss, a great loss of something, or a moment of enormous terror or something like that that restimulated an earlier engram, has a tendency there to charge up the engram. Your engram stops being mildly restimulated and stops being just a sleeper at that time and becomes a supercharged piece of pain, and it's created a big lock. Now, you call that a secondary engram. The reason it's called an engram at all is just this. People don't run them unless you call them engrams. They don't run them like engrams. They will put somebody through them once, and the person is exteriorized and he can't get into it, so they say, well, that's not important. There was no physical pain there anyhow. Actually, these secondary locks are run through and through and through again with all perceptics in reverie, and at that time, they are knocked out, just like engrams are. They're desensitized. The person gets into his own valence. You see, they run just like an engram. The person, for instance, won't get a grief charge off unless he's in his own valence. Well, the person can't get his own pain in an engram unless he's in his own valence. In other words, they run. We call these things secondary engrams because there are the points when an impact from the environment, which did not contain physical pain, yet contained such threat and menace to the individual, impinged upon a physical pain engram and restimulated it so thoroughly that it charged it up. If you could get all of the grief and all of this charge off of a case, you would have on your hands a release. Actually, if you could just get all the grief off of a case, you would have a release, because you would have bled the charge out of the engrams, and the engrams would go back and be sleepers. It takes a terrific impact to make one of these secondary engrams, like the death of an ally of that sort, a terrific loss would all of a sudden charge this thing up on the affinity line. An enormous slam into a person's communication line and so forth would dam up the communication line, you see, in one of these secondary locks. And you run these things out just like engrams. All right. Actually, these really become secondary engrams when they break down affinity, communication, reality simultaneously. They become their worst things. This is one of the reasons why two lovers parting and so on can cause such a terrific psychic reaction in one of them or both. Either you're breaking down two types of affinity. You're breaking down a very strong, probably sexual affinity and group affinity and personal affinity, and they're going out of communication with each other, and boy, do they go out of communication. And they break down, for instance, think of the words they use. Not, I'm not going to write to you anymore, but I'm not going to see you again. You see, they're talking about perceptics. And they disagree, and afterwards you will find them saying about each other that the other person was not true or trustworthy and so forth. In other words, the reality's been broken down.